Okay. So welcome everyone. I'm Jan from the Platypus Affiliated Society, and we have here the workshop Different Perspectives on the Left with the CPGP, with Paul DeMardi from the Provisional Central Committee of the CPGP, and he will introduce the project and the history of the project. So please go on.
Okay. I'm going to try and keep this brief because we're pressed for time, and also I have a tendency to use quite flowery, elaborate language. I'm aware that most people here do not speak English as a first language, so just shout if I'm being unclear. I also mumble a lot, which doesn't help. So the CP, I am a member of the CPGB. I have been a member of the CPGB for 8 years now, since summer of 2007, and the project goes back quite a bit further than that, so I'll probably start with the kind of history. I won't go too far into it, but essentially in the early 80s there was still a substantial official kind of Stalinist Communist Party in Britain, the CPGB as it was then. It was at that time basically descending into crisis. There was the leadership faction, which basically owned the party apparatus, had absorbed people who were called Eurocommunists, who wanted to ditch the remaining attachments to the Soviet Union, and essentially pushed the CPGB into being a reformist think tank. There were, on the other hand, a lot of pro-Soviet opposition factions, the largest of which was Straight Left, and they wanted to continue to uphold the socialist countries and keep the Moscow line, and they also opposed the sort of think tankification of the party. What they wanted, rather, was to turn it into a ginger group in the trade unions, which wasn't really much better. So we had, at that time, there were four founding individuals who started a journal called The Leninist, and that's the predecessor to what we are today. The Leninist was critical of the Soviet Union and socialist countries, but it was quite similar to something like the Spartacist League, or I don't know if anyone's familiar with the Marcionites, who are an American tendency coming out of Trotskyism, where they were critical of the Soviet Union and the GDR and so on, but nonetheless defended it as a gain of the working class against imperialism, US imperialism, and that sort of thing. So it was also a very avowedly revolutionary faction, so very much about promoting sort of militant strike struggles and supporting the Irish national liberation struggle that was very significant at the time. The overall objective was essentially to clear out the leadership of the CPGB and replace it with a properly Leninist leadership. And to do that, they had this journal, and that was scandalous. You know, they were the only faction in the CPGB that openly admitted to being a faction. Everyone else pretended to not be because it was against the rules. So that was the kind of novelty. We didn't succeed. But the CPGB was wound up in 1991. Of course, the socialist bloc also fell in toto, essentially, in 89, 91. I guess you've got China and Vietnam, but, you know, it's pushing it a bit. And, of course, the entire left went into a sort of... Many didn't realise it at the time, but they had been plunged into crisis, and the 1990s was essentially a lost decade. for the left in Britain and in a lot of other places as well. Under the pressure of that, the organisation opportunistically seized the name CPGB when the old one was wound up. That got us a certain amount of, well, it was an important propaganda point to say that, you know, these people have no right to shut down the Communist Party. They're just scum. You know, it belongs to us. Kept hold of it and relaunched The Leninist as The Weekly Worker, which we still publish today. Hit issue 1,000 last year or the year before, I can't remember. So at that point, the comrades who remained, who didn't dissolve, as a lot of people did at that point, reconsidered things quite radically. Commitment to Soviet defensism was retrospectively dropped. We decided we had been wrong about the nature of the Soviet bloc, about the nature of the communist parties that were ruling in those countries, and increasingly, although we continue and we always have continued to propagandize with the rest of the British left, that increasingly meant we were dealing with Trotskyist organizations or quasi-Trotskyist organizations. And in Britain, there is a kind of smorgasbord of little Trot groups, whereas in other countries, you tend to get a smorgasbord of little Maoist groups. In Britain, Trotskyism is dominant in the far left, in the left of Stalinism, if you see what I mean. That brings us up to now and what our project is now. The CPGB is a propaganda organisation. We've nicked the name Communist Party, but we are not a party. For us, a party is a part of the class. You can't be a party with a small handful of members publishing a weekly paper. It's simply a contradiction in terms. And in fact, for us, there is no party worthy of the name on the British far left. There's a Labour Party, and then there are propaganda groups, small sects. But for us, it would be possible to form out of this mass a party worthy of the name, even if it only had a few thousand members, if it was united in advocating a revolutionary alternative to capitalism and for a working class revolutionary alternative to capitalism, then that would amount to a qualitative change in the working class movement in Britain. So our propaganda is targeted at we don't have an agitational paper that we typically hand out on street stalls or demos that tells people that the Tories are really bad and the NHS is good, and which is pretty much the meat and potatoes of strikes are very good as well. This is what you get in British left-wing publications. We're unapologetically targeted at people who have already gone with us some of the way, primarily the rest of the organised left, and secondarily the unorganised left, individuals and small ginger groups that identify as Marxist. And finally, that part of the wider trade union movement and labour movement that considers themselves as socialists or advocates of working class politics in some sense. We're not targeted at the everyday Joe. We would essentially be asking some guy in the street to join a party that doesn't yet exist, which would be a complicated sell. So that informs the character of our paper. In the meantime, we fight as far as we can for what we believe we need, the Marxist left in Britain to unite and openly state its Marxism, that really stands for a revolutionary working class alternative to capitalism. an international revolutionary working class alternative to capitalism. That's basically it. The rest is, you know, details. But very important details, and we would want to work them out. But the core of the idea is simply that. And in to that end, we participate in attempts to unify different parts of the left. There have been a number of them over the years. The Socialist Labour Party, the Socialist Alliance, Respect, slightly dodgy one. Now Left Unity, which is going into a crisis of its own because of the Labour Party. That's another thing, possibly for tomorrow. And within these things, we argue, look, it's not enough just to get people in a room. You need to need to be for something, and what you should be for is a revolutionary break with capitalism. You can't pretend to be the old Labour Party when the old Labour Party still actually exists. This is normally what people want these unity projects to do. I guess just two other things. We organise on a democratic centralist basis. Anyone who was at the panel we've just visited would know that there is a great deal of disagreement as to what that actually means. But Manuel, who's in the other room, stated our position on it fairly clearly. Democratic centralism means uniting in action and democratically deciding on actions. It does not mean shutting up if you have a disagreement, particularly if that disagreement is over some matter of theory, like whether the Soviet Union was a capitalist society or a degenerated worker state. The idea that there should be a binding line on that, and nobody should be able to openly speak in the outside of an internal bulletin as to whether that's true or not, is to us absurd. Our paper is open to oppositional voices within our own organisation, you know, also from the broader left, but that's the point. You're not required to pretend you agree with something you disagree with, but when it comes down to it, if we've decided that we're going, I don't know, vote for such and such a Labour MP, and you think he's a terrible bastard and you don't want to vote for him, okay, we can't follow you into the ballot box, but you should be voting for that, whatever you think about it. And similarly in a trade union congress or something like that, if there was a motion up that we had a agreed line on. We think this is more than just a technical matter. This is actually about the sort of society we want to create. We want to create a society where the producers democratically organize themselves and society as a whole. And that means allowing massive disagreements to be aired. And if we can't do it in our little group, then how the hell do we expect to convince people that 5 years, 20 years down the line, it'll be different? No, we will, by actually being in it, no one's under any illusion, you know, no one's ever confused about what the line of the CPGB is on something. You know, somehow that message gets across, even though we allow open disagreements. We make the argument that, yes, we can have an effective organisation without shutting people up by simply operating in that way. Finally, there's the international question. Our strategy in the longer term is for not just a Communist Party of Great Britain that actually deserves the name rather than pinched it cheekily in the early 90s, but for a Communist Party of the European Union. This is because communists should organise at the level, at least the level at which capital is organised, and capital is organised on a Europe-wide scale within Europe. There were, you know, similar strategic imperatives would apply in other regions of the world. You know, why would you, you would want, you know, in that sense, a united Party of all of Latin America. You know, there is a commonality there that would make it possible. And we argue, you know, we argue that we need to start now. We need to start thinking about how we can get united, even just simple things like trade union days of action. Why can they not be coordinated? Why can't we have a single day public sector strike in Germany and Britain and France and Belgium? You just list countries at this point. But the point is, it's already there. The union's already there. We do what, you know, our paper is read in a lot of different countries, and it's just, and you know, there is an international exchange of ideas on the broader left. So why are we all not taking this seriously when it's transparently obvious, certainly from the Greek case, whatever else one wants to say about Syriza, that Varoufakis rode his motorbike around Europe and visited finance ministers to see if anyone agreed with him, and it seems that actually the EU is perfectly capable of operating in a democratic centralist fashion and crush them. Right, if we can't organise on that basis, we're never going to win. So that's I'll probably stop there. That's, I've talked for about 20 minutes. And,
that's okay. Yeah. I mean, we would have more time for remarks of yours, but if you want to open it...
I think that's the bare bones.
So we'll open it if there are any questions. If not, I have one for yours, and that would be... you pointed as that the question, for example, of the capital of the Soviet Unions are more or less accidental or unimportant byworks today. So, but nevertheless, there these questions really, I mean, represent practical differences in the left today and practical stances on different topics. I would wonder how you would handle, ideological differences in the left that really do have a practical matter for those groups and are not simply to be solved by being forgotten. Mm.
Well, I mean, specifically on the Soviet issue, we do have to unite on the principle that we do not want to repeat it. You know, people who think that, you know, there are people in Britain who think that in the 1930s the Soviet Union was a workers' paradise, and not very many people were killed, and most of them deserved it. You know, this is a strategically incompatible position. There would be no point uniting with people who take that opinion. But you know, somebody thinks that the terrible Soviet society was a degenerated worker state versus somebody who thinks that it was a state capitalist society or some other thing. Like, these questions are important because we do need to base ourselves on a high level of theory. But theory doesn't happen through votes; it happens through ongoing arguments that can take decades. So we want to be able to contain different theoretical perspectives so they can enrich themselves and then guide us better later. In the short term, we merely need to agree that the socialism in one country is a dead end, essentially. And we can argue about the exact reasons why until we have a better idea. I mean, what are the chances that we have already completely, somebody out there has already said all there is to say about the Soviet Union? That, you know, really, some stuff we're only just learning about now. There are certainly things that are more immediately pressing as an example, okay, the falling rate of profit versus disproportionality versus underconsumptionism, all these different theories of crisis. Okay, that does actually bear on whether you think there's going to be another crisis in the next 5-10 years. So maybe you'd have a different idea of that. But I think what's incumbent on people to do is provide a plan of action for, and then we can vote on it. You know, and people who lose the vote, you know, can say at a later date, this isn't working and I told you so, or be convinced. So we need to sort of separate these levels. Absolutely, it's important to have serious theoretical argument, but we need to be realistic about how these things can be settled. And the idea that you have a vote and you've decided the nature of the Soviet Union is profoundly anti-scientific, if nothing else.
Okay. Two.
I would like to ask CPGB's opinion about the demand for a dictatorship of the proletariat. Mm. What's your stance about that, as opposed to the call for a democratic republic or democracy?
Mm. I'm going to take another one and I can do
if there is another one. I mean,
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I want to know more about what are you guys thinking about Corbyn and what's going on with that?
About Corbyn.
I think we do the first one.
Yeah, we start. It's like, yes, I mean, work our way back from dictatorship of the proletariat to good old Jeremy. The dictatorship of the proletariat as a phrase originates in the kind of remaining culture of the classics and the German Academy. What Marx has in mind is the Diktatura, a temporary period of military rule that could be used to save the Republic in Rome. Over the years, it began to be used just interchangeably with socialism, or Kautsky wrote a book called The Day After the Social Revolution, that situation. And then later on, it became thought of in the communist movement as a special social phase between capitalism and socialism, which would then lead to communism, which was a extended period of organization for civil war, effectively. For us, there's a certain amount of sort of deciding arbitrarily what words mean. When we say the dictatorship of the proletariat, we consider it synonymous with working class rule. We mean it in that sense just literally. And for us, that simply describes the highly democratic regime that we intend to set up as quickly as possible after a revolution, that we would be arguing for in the run-up. So in that sense, that it is the same as the Democratic Republic for us. We believe that we're aiming for a society where votes actually reflect popular opinion, unlike in Britain, where reflect rotten electoral system. We want annual parliaments, we want the election of all officials, we want no standing army, popular militia, and all these things. So an absolute radical reconstruction of society. Whether that comes out of Soviets or comes out of something else is a side issue for us. You know, we like Soviets and everything, but we don't make as much out of them as Trotskyists and so on. Corbyn, this is... in the last 15, 20 years... The sort of standard common sense, and it's not like incomprehensible, but the standard common sense on the British left is that the Labour Party is just completely dead. It's ceased to be any kind of working class organisation. It's just like the Tories, blah 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 blah. Now this is a period in which we've had Tony Blair. You know, this is the Iraq War, privatisation of schools and tuition fees and really horrible, you know, laws about relating to the war on terror and things like that. So it's perfectly understandable that left-wingers don't want any association with it. But for us, it always remained, you know, it was never up to that much anyway. It was always a party of imperialism, a party loyal to the British state. And the conditions after the fall of the Soviet Union simply meant that a party of that kind was going to be much more right-wing. Whenever there were the unity projects I was talking about, the SLP, Socialist Alliance, our line was precisely, it's pointless trying to do this because the Labour Party isn't dead. And there may well come a time when it swings sharply to the left. And that appears to have happened. The significance of Corbyn's victory is partly just an enormous historic accident. He should never have been allowed on the ballot in the first place. But once he was, it revealed that the Labour right was at a low ebb, that it was just exhausted by the prospect of five more years in opposition and the fact that various other things like cronyism and so forth. Basically, all the right-wing candidates were idiots, and I mean this seriously, they were unable to say anything remotely intelligent. And then you have this one guy who says what he actually thinks, just fancy that. And he won, with a crushing victory. And we are not left Labourites. We think his project in the ultimate strategic term is hopeless. But this is actually more or less the first advance of the left in 30 years almost in Britain, whatever its flaws. And ironically, of course, it has sent most of the existing left into complete crisis, because it staked so much on this idea that the Labour Party is dead. So it's too early to tell what will come out of it. He may be just defenestrated, just gotten rid of by right-wing MPs. Who knows? But there is an opportunity there to talk to new layers of people and try and convince them of something a little bit with a bit more backbone than we should all be nice to each other and isn't war bad and the sort of stuff you get out of Corbyn. So it's a very important event in British politics. But it's too early to say exactly what its importance will be.
Mm-hmm. So you had one question?
Yeah.
Go for it.
About the you obviously want the existing Marxist left in Britain to come together.
Mm.
Now, are there actually precedents or plans for, you know, integrating an existing organization as a faction or whatnot?
Mm.
Because it's obviously not just a matter of agreeing on a program, but also of conserving a kind of identity and a kind of rallying point that people have identified with for a good deal of their life.
Mm.
So it's not something that's given up easily.
Mm. In terms of precedence, the formation of the original CPGB in 1920 was, the majority was previously the British Socialist Party. There was a Socialist Labour Party which was De Leonist, it's more or less forgotten, but then quite important left-wing trend. A minority split that organisation and took part of it into the CPGB. There were one or two other things like that. So sort of the question is precisely, these people have been committed to De Leonism for 10 years. They hate the Labour Party. The BSP is an affiliate to the Labour Party, you know. So that was, it was a big question back then as well. So what they did, they did it the old-fashioned way and had a Congress that lasted for a week and argued it out and voted on it. And at the end of it, they had a party of 4,000 or 5,000 people that became 10,000 by the mid-30s, I think. So, you know, there are historical precedents for this kind of thing. And you could go back further. You could go back to Germany, the Gotha unification. These things can happen. In our own history as a faction, we've tended to recruit individuals, but we've recruited them from all over the place. Mike Minnaire is probably the most internationally known intellectual that we have. It's not a huge field there, but nonetheless. He's a Trotskyist background. Briefly flirted with Marxism and things like that, so maybe fairly similar to what the Leninists were saying, but you know, again, just completely the other side of the world. I mean, I stumbled upon it trying to break away from anarchism on an individual basis on the internet, you know. So that's not the same thing as obviously a proper fusion where you do need to manage things quite carefully and try and make sure that everyone's represented on the leadership and that sort of thing. But, you know, it's I don't, but it's often said that it's incredibly difficult to do this because how do you expect all these people to come together? So, well, in some situations, okay, in 1920 you had this October Revolution looming over your shoulder, but in some situations, yes, people go, oh, Jesus Christ, let's just have a vote and we're better together.
Do you want to go for one more? Or?
Yes, I want to remind this one thing. If you can explain a little bit about, I know that it's difficult to explain in a limited time, about the strategy, because you have said, if I have understood correctly, that you have cleared the goal and you have to go for towards a society in which the producers are organized democratically.
Mm.
But the how is only details, so a matter of details. I don't know if I have understood correctly, but I think that is quite important. I mean, so how to reach this majority. Mm. Which strategies do you have to reach this majority, especially in a situation in which culturally and the working class organization are quite weak, at least in my country. I don't know if you can. You
can.
Yeah.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, we have him first and then.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, maybe going in the other direction, whether you have any experiences you could talk about with us, let's say about, like you said, about trying to coordinate things like strike days. Are these things that you simply been advocating in the newspaper and it remains a level of propaganda, or have you had any experiences actually trying to get something like that going?
Okay, so we'll leave it at that, and
would you like to take one more?
The third. Okay, so go
for it. I'm glad I wasn't there from the beginning, so maybe it was addressed while I was absent. But I would like to ask, in what terms, historically, the problem of democracy, as I get it, is the main symptom for you to work on? I mean, from what I understand, not only as a means to an end, but also as an end in itself, democracy seems to be, let's say, the fundament or the main goal to be achieved. And I was wondering if I would like you to comment on that. And given that in the Marxist history, democracy was a problem, let's say, of the crisis of liberalism, but wasn't described as an end in itself. It was rather a symptom of bourgeois society. So I would like you to make that a connection if it's possible.
Okay. Yes, when I say these are details, obviously the details do matter. And you know, we have a draft program which is our strategy as it stands, turned into, you know, demands about this, demands about that. Obviously our immediate activity, as I said, is directed at attempting to create greater unity on the Marxist left and more principled unity. But say that we did get our, you know, small little, you know, Communist Party of Great Britain of 3,000 members or something like that, then what do? We attempt to, we have a, you know, I couldn't go through everything, but we want to do everything we can to turn that into an organisation that's massive across society. So that means obviously participating and wherever possible leading immediate day-to-day struggles in, say, trade unions and workplaces. It means attempting to organise mutual aid societies. It means massively trying to educate people on how, in that sense, society works and how they can make a change in it. There's we are not enormously hostile to prefigurative politics. I think there's a limit to what you can do with that, but nonetheless, there isn't going to be one moment of incredible revolutionary rupture that just comes out of the blue. We have to prepare and organise a mass movement and use every bit of leverage we can. The programme would answer probably a little bit more in terms of the detail. actually, you know, doing some of these highfalutin things? Well, essentially the answer is not for a while, shall we say. In 1984, 1985, there was obviously the miners' strike in Britain. It was an enormous event, and at that point, we kind of switched out of propaganda mode and just did everything we could to try and do what we thought was needed, which was organise self-defence squads, turning the... There was a lot of what they called minor support committees that would try and, you know, financially support miners, and we wanted to turn them into kind of proto-Soviets and that kind of thing. So that would be a kind of example, but again, even then, we had small forces, we got some echoes and had some successes here or there, but we didn't make the difference, shall we say. And we, you know, there has not been something that we've been thinking, right, we just have to throw ourselves into it on that basis. Maybe something will come out of the Corbyn stuff that will be worth it, but it would, it's difficult to tell. And, you know, we can't get people out on strike in Britain as us. And we obviously can't get people out on strike all over Europe, but the left could, is the point. Democracy is a symptom of bourgeois society. I mean, you know, this is platypus jargon. Indirectly, in the sense that the proletariat is a symptom of bourgeois society. Democracy is won by the proletariat. It grows out of the self-undoing of capitalism, of its throw. It's part of the grave digger. Capitalism creates its own grave digger. Democracy is kind of the spade. It's not an end in itself. The end in itself is communism, the withering away of all forms of state, including democracy. It's the end goal of the phase of history that we are now in, which is the decline of capitalism, its increasing irrationality and barbarism, and hopefully the transition from that to socialism. That is the first chapter of hopefully a more dignified human world. But Marx and Engels expended enormous amounts of energy supporting democratic struggles all over the world. It was the first things that the First International took positions on: Polish national liberation and victory for the North in the American Civil War. You know, these are not about, you know, just economic issues pertaining to the workers. It's like their whole project was the working class has to lead the battle for democracy and win it that way, because the bourgeoisie by that point was plainly not up to scratch, and anyone who thought that they were was kidding themselves.
You want to answer the last? Oh, no.
Then that was three of them. Was there another one? Have I missed somebody?
You mentioned the strike.
I mentioned it briefly.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you answered.
But I mean, I answered it and said, "Well, we, you know, I can't go out with my megaphone and get a strike happening in Britain, so I can't obviously do it in Germany either. You know, it's something that the left could do as a whole." As my
answer. Okay. On the issue of democracy.
Yeah, you can have one remark, and I will pop.
If you want, can you please clarify if there is any shift for the demand of democracy from, let's say, Marx and Engels' time, or the social democracy as it was in the late 19th century to nowadays? I mean, you just said that Marx and Engels thought that the proletariat, in a sense, could lead the struggle for democracy.
Mm.
Do you see that happening today with all these, the demand of democracy again, like with the square movement, with the Arab Spring? Because our period was, the central demand was democracy. And everybody was struggling for it, in a dark way, I would say.
Mm.
There was not a Marxist lens on it, so can you please elaborate a little bit?
Another one on that topic, democracy was the name in which centrally, I mean, counter-revolution happened in after 1917 in Germany, and the SPD and all the old social democratic parties basically shut down the socialist revolution in the name of democracy. So by preferring democracy over socialism, so could you comment on that? I mean, in light of that history, how you relate that to your concept of democracy? And the second one would be on Corbyn. You said you would hope to progress with him in running the Labour Party and the further development or engagement within the Labour Party. I would like to know how you would envision progress on that basis and what that might look like.
Adding to this, if they expect a crisis in the Labour Party, mm-hmm. and where they base that.
Okay. I'll take the first two of those together. Precisely the complication of the 1917 to 1923 period does problematize the word democracy. I think it just happens to be the correct word for what we want, so we need to clarify it somewhat. When Kautsky says, well, you know, hold back, you know, we have, not so much Kautsky, but he gets pulled along with it, because by this point he's a pretty pathetic figure, they identify the new sort of republic handed down by the generals as, this is democracy, we've got the democratic republic. You can read Kautsky in 1905 howling French socialists who say that about the French Third Republic. And just, it's complete nonsense. You've got an army and they're onto the teeth. You do not have a democratic republic just because you don't have a king, you know, and various other things of that kind. Concurrently, you have in Russia the situation, and this is it's kind of odd because obviously I'm talking about this tomorrow as well. So anyway, you have a situation where there's a war on. Yeah. It is impossible to organize a full-scale war democratically. You know, Trotsky has a lovely phrase that, you know, as long as we have wars of, you know, this level of brutality, you're going to have to put the soldier between the possible death at the front and the certain death at the rear. You know, it's military organization is inherently anti-democratic. It's one of the reasons why one prefers not to have big wars. So then you have this kind of hypocritical criticism of, you know, from Kautsky, of the mobilizations necessary to fight the war. And you get Lenin's reply, the proletarian revolution and the renegade Kautsky, where you get this, unfortunately, it ends up being over-theorized as, well, there's proletarian democracy and there's bourgeois democracy, and proletarian democracy means that, you know, we can take some liberties here and there in order to ensure the rule of the working class. And it's a complete theoretical hodgepodge. No one has ever given me a satisfactory definition of the difference between the two that did not leave at least one of them obviously just not democratic. But unfortunately it's been taken up as gospel, particularly by Trotskyists and so on, and it's just sort of a bit obfuscatory. Moving on to today, we have, as you mentioned, the square movements or the indignados and that kind of thing. I don't want to, you know, make a huge amount out of these movements. I think too much was made out of them at the time, really. You know, it wasn't somebody camped in Syntagma Square that moved things along in Greece. For better or worse, you needed a serious political party to do it. And that serious political party was obviously Syriza, with long historic roots in the Greek communist movement. they're all talking about something real. You know, they have been denied democracy. It doesn't matter who they vote for. They get to choose between essentially corrupt fraudsters. This is the reality of what the bourgeoisie calls democracy. It's like, well, you have endless checks and balances to dilute the popular will. You have systematic bribery of officials. I say system, I don't mean that in literally people handing brown envelopes, but it works as a system. You know, this is the media in particular, because it's run by the capitalist class, can present any politician they like as either an angel or a devil, and these people are disenfranchised. And okay, so their movements go nowhere. They go nowhere because we have failed to build a party that could integrate them and say, well, you know, in that sense, give them a more profound understanding of what it is they want, and in that sense, how to get it. And that's what's missing, you know, in terms of working class leading the battle for democracy. It means, first of all, saying, well, this is what democracy is, this is why we don't have it, and this is how we can get it. And that's, you know, if you accept the Marxist axioms about the working class being the revolutionary class, then that all kind of works. I probably can't get into that now. Corbyn and progress in the Labour Party. We like strategies. We have a strategy for the Labour Party. Our strategy for the Labour Party is to radicalise the element of it which is an affiliate umbrella organisation for diverse institutions. Trade unions are affiliated, you have Fabians, you have socialist lawyers, I think. It's all kinds of odd little things. And we want to generalise that. We want to overturn the undemocratic bans and prescriptions that stop, you know, communist organisations from joining. Ultimately, we want to purge it of the right. We've actually been in the bourgeois press a couple of times recently. Like, look at these scary communists, they support Corbyn and they want to purge the right. Yeah, great. Then at the end of it all, it could be essentially become the equivalent of a sort of Supreme Soviet, you know. Okay, what's a Soviet? It's a council. Okay, right, the Labour Party's decision-making mechanisms could just as well serve that role as a factory committee. Soviets in 1917 weren't really the same as the Soviets in 1905 anyway. So that, yeah, we may or may not achieve that. I mean, obviously at the moment we're not going to be able to force it by ourselves, but there is a possibility that we could remove some of the supports for the right wing in the Labour Party and get progress towards it. You know, is there going to be a crisis in the Labour Party? There already is a crisis in the Labour Party. There is great chaos under heaven, as Mao put it. You have a bizarre situation where the Labour Party is kind of like a sandwich. So at the top you have the left. At the bottom, you have a large rank and file, which, as it turns out, is quite left-wing. And in the middle, you have this dreary right-wing apparatus, desperately, and the PL, Parliamentary Labour Party, which is overwhelmingly from the right, desperately trying to regain control. So it's a sort of quite interesting situation at the moment. And unfortunately, because the Labour left was in no better shape than the rest of the left until... apparently last week, we're from a standing start, really, and trying to get our act together to actually win. That's what, in that sense, we critically support Jeremy Corbyn because he is a representative of the party's left wing, but we oppose left labourism in the movement. We want to, you know, replace it, defeat it, and, you know, get Marxism more popular. But inasmuch as the right is on the back foot in the Labour Party, that presents new opportunities for us to fundamentally transform what it is, and unfortunately, you know, those left-wingers who are now going in or going into the Labour Party, having said it was crap for 20 years, will be going in just to be cheerleaders for Corbyn, because nobody ever learns anything in Britain. But who knows? It's an exciting time.
Okay, so do we have other remarks, questions? Or shall we... Because we're short in... I mean, we... We're short in time, yeah. And probably some of you would like to.
James promised that he would raise the call for a Communist Party of the European Union to the next panel from the audience or something like that. So we won't have to discuss it here. You can bring it on in the discussion there if it's possible.
Yeah. Okay, so I'd say we wrap it up, and you have the opportunity to get some food or whatever in front of the panel.
Thank you.
Where you had some good to
go? I like
it. Stop it. Was it just stop it?
Yeah.
So now you have two.